the Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast for people who love books by two siblings who love books.
Like, yeah, a lot.
I like books more than me.
That's a lie. You like nothing better than me.
I like me better than everything because I read.
I was going to do so. I like books, so I talk good.
I like books more than Thresh from Hunger Games.
Face it, Thresh couldn't read.
It seems kind of unlikely. He couldn't speak in complete sentences.
Yeah, I doubt they really got down to reading books in District 11.
You don't think they educated them in classic literature before they went and hit the fields?
They're probably like, hey guys, let's read some Frederick Douglass so you can get ideas about freedom and oppression.
That's right.
Great idea. Anyway, I'm Gabs.
I'm Ben.
And, yeah, this is Novel Ideas.
Yeah. So, I'm going to drop the spoiler policy on you here real quick.
Like we forgot last
week.
Like
we totally forgot last week. And basically, it is that we will spoil everything.
Yes, we talk about the book as a whole. And we usually don't get to every single point, but we will talk about the last page if the last page is interesting.
If we think of it.
Right.
So, yeah, if you're the sort of person who is bothered by that, then this would be a good time to tune out. And I would drop a spoiler bomb on you, but this book doesn't really have a plot.
Of Glenn hangs herself?
Of Fred doesn't have a real name?
Yeah, I guess. We've done several books in a row that don't really have big spoiler moments. We're going to have to change that.
I'm a little disappointed by that.
Figure
it out. Next week we'll have one.
Okay, good. All right. So we just wanted to do a little bit of listener response before we get started on the book.
All right, who is talking to us this week?
Well, first we have our good friend David, and he listened to the Wrinkle in Time podcast and our speculation over whether or not it counted as science fiction or fantasy. And he said he thought the difference was that in the science fiction realm, they actually try to go to lengths to explain what's going on. And in science fantasy, it's more just like, oh, this is happening. And it might be technological or futuristic, but they don't really bother to tell you how.
Yeah, he's the classic example of Star Trek where they'll bend themselves in circles trying to explain why something happened, whereas in Star Wars they go, laser swords, lol!
Yeah, the Force. It's just a thing. We don't know if it's magical or technological.
Right.
Or...
and then when they try to explain it, the fans actually get pissed off, so...
Midichlorians!
There you go.
Fuck you, George Lucas. The other suggestion David had, though...
Oh, yeah, he asked, he said it would be convenient for those trying to follow along at home if they could have our schedule, like knowing what we're going to read and what we're going to be broadcasting week to week. And we agree, that would be convenient. So we now have a schedule page up on our website.
Yep, we added a tab up at the top called Schedule, and right now we're just listing the books and the dates that the podcast will be published. As far in advance as we have them planned out.
Yes, which sometimes is 1 week and sometimes is three or four.
Right now it's three or four because we have the stand on there and that's like 1,000 pages long.
Yeah,
so.
We wanted to give ourselves a few weeks to read ahead before we had to read 1,000 pages in a week. Maybe only 600 that actual week.
So yeah, if you're interested in reading along and not scrambling to pick up the book as soon as you see that it's been posted or hear about it the week before, then you can go check out our schedule page.
Yeah, and if you're listening to us somewhere other than through our webpage, then go check it out.
www.novelideaspodcast.com.
Hooray! All right, we also heard from Caitlin, who thought it was interesting that women tend to connect with this book maybe a little more so than men, and mentioned a couple reasons she thought this might be possible, such as the nurturing quality of the characters, a lack of traditional macho type of characters, which is actually something we kind of meant to talk about a little bit last week. All of the adult women or otherworldly creatures that are over 2 billion years old have kind of a mothering aspect to them.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
And even the male characters, like Calvin, who plays a sport, he's still not, you know, stereotypical jock boy.
Yeah, he's, oh, Meg, you're cool. I like you. I accept you. And when there's danger, he's like, I'm going to help by propping everybody up and by being strong, but, like, in kind of a background sense instead of, I'm going to step in its way and punch it in its stupid face.
Right. His strength is actually communication, which is typically attributed to women.
Very true.
And the other thing that, well, the specific phrase she used that I liked is she said she thought Langle's characters have a lot of emotional intelligence, which I think is true. A lot of the characters try to figure out what they're feeling or tell people how they're feeling, and they don't do a lot of, like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't feel like that. Katniss, cough, cough.
Yeah, right?
Which might be a reason that people typically view the book as a little more feminine, since, again, women are typically attributed more emotional intelligence than men are, which is not fair, of course, but...
But it does tend to be how they are portrayed in, well, storytelling, whatever media you choose, really. She also left us a comment on iTunes.
Yay, Caitlin! Woo! We have one comment on iTunes.
That's right. So our iTunes profile is now only 99.99% clueless and shitty.
We actually, iTunes said we don't have enough reviews yet to give us an average. So I think we need like probably 3 or 4 more.
No way. Our average is 5 out of 5. We're amazing.
Best podcast ever.
That's right.
So anyway, thanks David and Caitlin, and I guess we'll move on to the...
Yeah, that brings us to this week, The Handmaid's Tale.
By Margaret Atwood.
In kind of an interesting read. Why did we read it?
Well, I've actually heard about Margaret Atwood, but I never had to read her. If you've ever heard of The Blind Assassin, that's kind of her other big name book. I'm sure there are other ones out there I'm just not thinking of at the moment. But I'd heard of The Handmaid's Tale before, and I heard it had something to do about birth and something about the future, and, I mean, it's basically considered a modern classic, so I thought, eh, why not? Give it a shot.
That description Gabs just gave is basically how she described it to me, and show you how easy it is to convince me to read something. I said, okay, I'll read that.
That sounds interesting.
Oh, birthing and women and... modern classic book. Okay, I mean,
I heard she's a good author.
I heard she's a good author.
I don't know.
I
will amend myself. I think I said at the end of the last podcast it was published in the late 90s because our particular version of the book was published in the late 90s, but the book was actually published in 1986. So sorry about that.
Yeah.
To anyone out there.
And if you read the book, that actually is a little obvious by the technology in it. We'll probably get to that in a few moments, though. So, the genre here, we've already said modern classic, so that usually implies some sort of contemporary literary fiction, but this is a little bit of what goes into the broad category of science fiction, in that it's a alternate near future history sort of thing. It might not even be an alternate so much as it is. It's 2012. The book was written in 1986. And we're actually living in Gilead right now.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really say how long it takes the transition to happen from the past as we know it to Gilead. So it's possible that the characters in this book are living right around now.
Yeah, I mean, the transition seemed awfully fast from the way the story was told.
Yeah, and it might have even happened in the early 90s, and maybe Gillian's already done.
We're already in the middle period.
Who knows?
And so another term that's been floating around to describe this book is speculative fiction, which was actually the phrase I came up with right before Gabs told me that's what some people call it. And I said, yes! And so speculative fiction is... it's not quite as specific, but in some ways is more specific than science fiction. So it's something that's happening in the future based on maybe less technology and more a modern trend.
Yeah, the thing I was thinking is it's a lot more looking into how society is structured and the way society works as opposed to the stuff they, the technology they use to run society or, you know, go into space or whatever.
Right. So 1984 would be more speculative fiction.
Than science fiction. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I always tend to classify science fiction as having a spaceship in it.
You tend to think of outer space and going planet to planet, or at least hard enough science fiction that there's some sort of really technological basis for it. Some of the Michael Crichton books, though, some of those are really just good old-fashioned fun. The sciences, not great in all of them. But the other reason I thought that phrase was a little bit interesting was because it's an older term. I haven't done enough research, as is par for this podcast, to confirm this, but I think it's possible it predates or comes around the same time, antedates, is that the right word, as science fiction.
I'm fucking it.
All right, just checking. Thought maybe that was a thing. I've seen that phrase used in letters or intros written in science fiction books that were published as early as the 1930s. So it's been around for a while, and of course now I'm sure there are people who have pedantically reclassified it and made it a very specific category of literature, because that's what we as people, especially as academic people, tend to do.
I just kind of tend to think, oh, speculative, they're speculating about what could happen in the future, and here's a book about it.
Oh yeah, and we need to throw the word dystopia in again, too.
Oh, yeah. We've been reading a lot of dystopias.
We talk a lot of dystopia. I would say, just offhandedly, that authors tend to look at dystopia more often than utopia. Because what's interesting in utopia?
No, not much.
Because most utopias turn out to be dystopias.
And the other thing about a dystopia is it's a lot easier to, if you want to get your message across, you know, oh, my message is that treating women as unequal is shitty. Well, I'm going to write a book where all the women are treated super shitty, and then by the end you realize what I think.
Right, as opposed to, I'm going to write a book that takes place in the near future where women have equal rights and everybody has healthcare. That's interesting. Where's the conflict?
I'd say with this sort of book, as an English major, one of the things they tell you when you read is that you can never read into the characters so much that you take what the author thinks and put it on the characters. So when you read Shakespeare, for example, you're not supposed to go, oh, Shakespeare is Catholic because this character is Catholic. Because, well, writers write, you know, whatever the fuck all the time. But I'd say in the case of books like this, of like The Handmaid's Tale, it's pretty solid to say that Margaret Atwood, not a fan of oppressing women.
Yeah, it seems to be the whole purpose of the book, in fact. And apparently we schedule our podcast recording for the same time the landscapers are working right outside my window.
Trying to, like, nobly push through the noise.
Jeez O'Malley!
Shut up. Said it one time my entire life. Happened to be on air. Whatever.
All right, so what's our synopsis?
The synopsis that we came up with is, all feminist accomplishments get totally boned.
Goodbye.
Anything you can think of, women working, women getting paid, women getting out of the home, women not having to have children, women not being victim blamed for getting attacked, all of that just totally out the window.
Yeah, that's actually like state policy now.
Yes, you got sexually assaulted because you were dressed like a slut deer.
Yeah.
Which is actually some shit that people still think today.
I've heard people say that.
Although feminists try really hard to say, you could be walking down the street naked, and if a guy rapes you, then he's a horrible monster.
And it's hard to disagree with that.
Yeah. I can't say that I've ever looked at someone and just been like, ugh! They're asking me to violate the shit out of them.
I've seen some attractive women or some not attractive women dressed in very small amounts of clothing in my life, and I can say that the level of dress has never before caused me to have the thought of raping someone in my head.
There is actually someone online who walked around for a day or two with a sign around their neck that said, or a shirt, I think, that said, kill me on it. And they're trying to prove a point that if they're walking around wearing a shirt that says, kill me, and then someone murders them, that person who murdered them is still going to jail.
Yes.
Because just because you're wearing a shirt that says, kill me, it doesn't mean someone has the right to kill you. And they were saying it's the same thing. If you're walking around in, you know, a bikini top and a mini skirt, that's not asking someone to come do something horrible
to you.
That's
certainly not a sign saying, rape me. And having been in downtown Miami before in the middle of the summer, I can assure you that a lot of people are dressing that way because we're close to the beach.
Yeah, and there's just, honestly, no excuse for it. I don't care if I'm getting on my little feminist soapbox right now. If you want to fight me about this, you can, but you're a douche and you will lose.
That's right. Drop some thoughts in the comment section so we can go to war.
This book has incited my feminist rage. I'm not going to be able to hold it back.
Well, that's good. That's what I was hoping for, honestly. yeah, I said right before we started recording, even the men in Dracula think that this society is too sexist. They're like, whoa, too far.
Yeah, think if Mina couldn't read and write, those guys would have, Dracula would have eaten their heads.
That's true.
Because Mina's the only one of them who isn't an idiot.
Dracula would be the secret king of London.
Yeah. Get it together.
That's right. So we've really talked about the setting already. Near future, presumably United States, I don't know what you would call it. I almost said kingdom, nation, country, theocracy.
I think they called it a monotheocracy.
Monotheocracy. Gilead, which was interesting to me, happens to be the name of the homeland of the protagonist from the Dark Tower series, for any of you who know that. And so, doing the usual light research on the internet.
Wikipedia.
Discovered a couple interesting facts about Gilead. It is a region in, I wasn't sure if it was in Israel or part of it on the border. Anyway, it's a hilly region.
In the Bible?
It's in the Bible several times. And the other Gilead-related trivia in the Bible that was interesting to me for this book, at least, is that Gilead was also the father of Jephthah, who... those of you who are musicians know it because of the oratorio, probably. For the rest of you, though, he was a general who needed victory in battle and made a deal with God to sacrifice his daughter should he win. And then he went out and won, and then he was sad.
Yeah, the way it works is Ben said it's kind of interesting because this guy sacrificed his daughter to do this other thing, and in this society in Gilead, they're basically sacrificing women because whatever.
Yeah, maybe that's how they won their battle to kill all of Congress in one day.
I just, like, the Senate is 100 people, which is a lot, but when they say Congress, you're like, oh my God, the House of Representatives is... 400 plus, and that is just...
And they referred to it as a machine gunning, which seems a little implausible to me. Like, you would have missed a couple, right?
they locked the doors and...
I really... I honestly don't want to picture the scene. It's disturbing.
The Banana Revolt, or... Oh, God, I'm not going to get their name right. In the 1920s in South America, where whatever fruit company down there... said, oh, come to us with your complaints, you can join in the square, and a bunch of people showed up in the square, and then they gated it off and just machine-gunned everyone down.
That was nice.
Because they wanted to keep cheaply producing their bananas. Yeah, apparently fruit has been exploiting South America for hundreds of years, so.
I've read that before, I have not heard that particular story.
Not the point of the book.
Yeah, anyway.
Just something I thought I'd bring up while we're talking about oppression. So the point of view of the book is first person...
Yes, entirely through of Fred.
Of Fred. I really like to call her Offred, just so it's a weird name and not of Fred.
Right.
The reason her name is of Fred is because the guy that she has been assigned to have his baby, his name is Fred.
Yeah.
And if you're assigned to a guy named Glenn, you'd be of Glenn.
And if you're assigned to Ben, you'd be of Ben.
Of Ben.
Gaps is looking at me with disgust in her eyes right now. For even putting my name in that hypothetical.
I do like that Glenn and Ben rhyme. But the reason this makes me so angry is all women have, you know, their original real names, but they all get wiped away from them, taking away their identity at the most basic level you can possibly take away someone's identity. And we never learn of Fred's real name. And I was completely determined that when she said her name at the end of the book, because I was convinced it was going to happen, that I would get to call her Elizabeth the entire podcast. I was going to refuse to call her of Fred, but now I have no other choice.
Maybe we should make a name up for her.
Like, we came up with awesome names for Piggy. Like, come up with awesome names for of Fred.
There you go. If you have any good alternate names for of Fred, head to the comments section. Let us know,
because it just makes me sad. But it's told through her point of view. As far as we know, it's a sort of diary.
Yeah, it seems kind of in the style of a diary. I mean, not all the way with date entries and all that like some books do, like Dracula did.
Yeah.
But it reads a little bit like a diary. It's very personal. There are a lot of feelings. There's not a ton of narrative for the most part.
And you get everything in sort of bits and pieces, like you might from someone who's just telling you the story. Whereas a historian would sit down and go, okay, here's how it happened, here's the things that were going on. You just get kind of what's happening to her in her everyday life, and then as she goes, you find out more about how the society she's in operates, and then you get little bits of flashback from how she got into this position.
Yeah, and the flashbacks are interesting because they tell the story both of how society transitioned into what it is now, well, now in the book, and how she herself had to go through that transition. Okay, so one day she goes to work and everybody's fired. All the women are.
Well, no, first she goes to buy a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah, it was on the way to work.
And her credit card, or whatever they call it.
Right.
It's not a credit card anymore. Doesn't work. Rejected. Her account's frozen.
Yeah.
She goes to work. All the women are fired. Get sent home. Now all of a sudden she has no job and no money. And apparently she calls a friend at... And every woman's bank account has been completely frozen.
Yep, your nearest, your husband or nearest male relative can access your funds.
Yeah, don't worry, your $2,000 will go to your husband.
Oh, good.
Oh, excellent.
That's just why I had my own account, so my husband could have it.
Yeah, I've been dreaming of the day I have to rely entirely on another person to take care of me. It's an awesome feeling.
Yeah. And so, yeah, starts there, and then they start rounding up the undesirables, and then they start separating people who are married a second time, or are perhaps having sex out of wedlock.
We should mention that the marriage a second time is actually the reason that of Fred is taken.
Yes.
Because her husband had previously been married.
Plus, she's proven fertile.
Yes.
She has a child.
She has a daughter, and so, well... A lot of people are having a hard time having babies, so take her to baby camp or...
Or wherever they're putting them.
Yeah. And we should say that a lot of these details you don't find out until almost the end of the book.
Yeah, you have references to it. You don't know specifically what happened.
Most of the really juicy bits are kind of interspersed at the end.
Yeah.
At first you just get, oh, I had a daughter, a man that I really cared about. She's kind of having these wistful little flashbacks while she's living this entirely boring, crappy, horrible life. And then as she gets more and more immersed into the political side of her current day life, she starts thinking more and more about the implications of how the past led into that.
Yeah, and actually the book opens in one of these flashbacks. You start in a gymnasium where all these women are kind of whispering to each other from their cots because it's about as much as they can get away with. Before we cut to the present day in the horrible room of boredom.
Oh my god. This sounded like the most exquisite torture you could ever come up with for anybody.
Yeah, you get a small room to yourself, and in that room you have a bed and
a chair.
Chair.
She has a dresser with a picture of a flower on it.
Yes. And some sort of cabinet.
Mm-hmm. That she to could... hang cloaks in.
Yeah, probably. And that's about it. Window won't open all the way, so you can't jump out of it.
And it's shatterproof, so you can't break through it.
Yep.
Slice yourself up.
You can't read or write. You're not allowed to. She knows how to, because she went to college.
Yeah. She grew up in the real U.S. 80s.
Yes.
According to the book. But, yeah, women aren't allowed to read anymore. She sits on a cushion that says faith. And she mentions how she'll just stare at it for hours on end because it's the only thing she can read.
Yeah. And they don't get games. They don't have electronics. They can't sit there and do crafts because they can't have anything sharp or anything they could harm themselves with.
I
was going to say, because surprise, surprise, these women have a tendency to commit suicide.
Yeah, if you had to sit in a chair for 10 hours all day staring out a window for days on end, you'd probably think suicide was a little more pleasant.
Yeah.
Especially considering that she doesn't really get to have relationships with other people, briefly gets to talk to some other people in the household, once a month is forced to have sex with the head of the household.
The highlight of her day is walking to the market and not making eye contact with anyone the whole time, and not really even being able to converse, truly.
Just whisper a little bit with her walking partner, but...
Yeah, but anything they say above whispering volume has to be...
Praise be.
Yes, very official sounding.
So, that sounds like the worst thing ever.
Can't read. I'm on board.
That's the one thing I was thinking is, oh my god... Being alone by yourself for 10 hours, the only way to make that even tolerable is being able to read.
A magazine? Something.
Something. But no. It's apparently been decided that reading will somehow make women worse.
I feel like I would bite my fingertips open and write on the wall.
Just so you can read something.
Something? Holy cow.
And I got that they didn't get the magazines anymore because... This new society considers, you know, Glamour and Vogue and I'm sure Cosmo to be, you know, horrible, sinful publications. But they can't read, you know, some nice, like, Little Women. They can't read the Bible.
You would think that there would be a copy of the Bible in that room, wouldn't you?
I would read the hell out of that. This is the only thing I had.
End up memorizing it. Maybe a book of the rules and regulations like they have in The Giver?
Yeah, something. But apparently the first mistake they ever made was teaching women how to read.
Well, that'll teach us.
I mean, obviously, if there was ever a movement that said women aren't allowed to read anymore, well, I guess I say obviously, but I feel like a lot of women would take offense to that.
I think most women would take offense to that. I think most men would take offense to that.
Yeah, I think I would probably fight until someone killed me if that was the case. But the other thing that baffled me about it is it's been proven in countries where women are still not as educated as men. If you educate these women and allow them to get jobs and start getting involved, the more gender equal your country is, the better off your country is. So they've actually discovered in some of these countries where they're finally starting to educate women and get women jobs that the condition of life improves for everyone.
Yes, the economy gets better, standard of living goes up.
It's not like just a, female empowerment thing. No, the men benefit too, and the families benefit, and the entire country starts to be a world player.
Also, men, let's be honest. Do you really want to hang out with women who aren't well-read and aren't intelligent and can't have a conversation with you? Like, it's just a hole on legs that you can have sex with? Sounds horrible.
Yeah, and the other thing about it is if there was an element of, she's just completely submissive to you and you can just, like, play weird sex games with her, like, that's, like, horrible, but then at least they're coming from some angle. But in Gilead, they are cutting out all the sexual desire too, so it's not like, here's a woman that I get to have sex with because she keeps on all her clothes. They basically just hike up her skirts and
the wife sits behind her.
Yeah, my wife is going to sit behind her while I have sex with her once a month, and other than that, you know, she's completely covered up, not a sexual object at all. They don't even really talk to each other.
Yeah, I mean, this society has tried to legislate sex out of existence.
It just sounds miserable for everybody.
It really does.
It's like they went out of their way to make everyone as sad as possible.
They could use some of those pills from the giver.
Yeah. the stirring pills.
The stirring pills, yes.
So, yeah. As a handmaid, which Fred is, she gets to sit in a room by herself for 10 hours a day. And her duty is to have a baby, should mention.
Yeah, her duty. And really, she has some amount of status through that. Like, you're protected, and part of the genesis of this society is that the birth rate has gone way down, and it's difficult to conceive now, and it's even more difficult to bear a baby that is actually healthy, apparently. And it's a status symbol for these well-connected men if they have a couple of kids.
Mm-hmm. And if their wives are too old to have kids anymore, or if it's been proven that their wives are unable to have kids, should mention that it's all women unable to have kids. Men are just assumed to be able to produce babies.
It's the old medieval theory of women can be sterile, but men can't.
Yes. So, if your wife's not getting pregnant, it must be because your wife can't get pregnant. But then they give you a handmaid, so you could potentially have a baby.
Yeah. That you take from her right after it's born, pretty much.
Yeah, kick her the hell out.
Didn't really mention what happens to the women, to the handmaids who successfully have a healthy baby. Now, if you go through your 3 2-year terms and you don't, you become an unwoman.
Mm-hmm.
Cue another rant. So if you can't have babies, you're not a woman, and if you're a woman, you're almost not a person. So I don't know what the hell that status really means, but
yeah, if you never have babies, you're unable to have babies, and you're not lucky enough to be a wife who
yes.
is a little bit more of a higher class woman, then yeah, you become an unwoman and you get sent off to the colonies,
by which they mean sent around the country to clean up toxic waste spills
until you basically die 2 years later,
until you die of it. Yeah,
because they don't give you any protection or anything.
Right, so I wonder if the handmaids who have children, see, I could have thought of this when we were thinking of questions earlier. get to graduate to econo-wives or something.
Yeah, or go to some kind of retirement for women who have fulfilled their duties or something.
Probably get released.
Yeah. Probably get sent off to the colonies anyway once they get old enough.
Probably.
I'm sure no one cares.
Maybe that's where the Marthas come from.
Oh, from women who haven't been able to have kids?
Yeah. Or the women who can't have kids, or maybe some of them will be ex-handmaids. We don't know anything about Middle Gilead.
So no, we don't.
There's no way to know for sure, but I do wonder a little bit about that, because it's implied there are grave consequences if you do not successfully have a baby, but it's never really mentioned what happens if you do.
Because no one ever, there's one birth in the book, but it doesn't end up being a successful.
Yeah, that's true. So, what do we know about of Fred, aside from her horrible existence? What kind of person is she?
Well, we knew that she had a kid, was married before all this happened.
Yeah. And that she was pretty attached to her husband and her child, as one should be.
As you would think.
That she was educated. She had her own job and her own money.
Mm-hmm. Her best friend was a hilarious feminist.
Yeah. Moira.
She was edging on, like, stereotypical, like, dyke feminist.
Yeah, definitely, that's become a character archetype. I don't know if that existed in 1986 or not.
I should mention that I said dyke because of the stereotype, and that I prefer the term lesbian. I just realized I might have, like, pissed someone off. It was not intended.
Moira's a type of lesbian who would call herself a dyke, look you in the eye, and threaten you to say something.
She totally would. And then she would, like, squeeze your balls and not give a fuck.
Tear them off and feed them to you.
She's pretty awesome. She's definitely one of the resistance fighters.
Yeah, she's the freest spirit of anyone in this book, unquestionably.
I think that's part of what makes the end so depressing, is that Moira spends the entire book fighting against all this, and at the end she just has to give up.
Yeah. Like, what can you do?
Yep. She said, well, you know, at least I don't have to be a handmaid. I'm a prostitute, but oh well.
Yeah.
And then Fred is thinking, oh my god, like...
what happened to you, Moira?
Yeah, no one can actually fight and beat the system. Eventually they will beat you down.
Yeah, and one thing I've talked about a little bit in the past is you see lots of stories where the underdog eventually overcomes giant odds, and I'd kind of like to see a story where the underdog is fighting giant odds the whole time and then gets crushed by whatever monolithic thing they're fighting, just because no one would see it coming, even though it's the most logical conclusion. And it turns out when that actually happens, it's really depressing.
Yeah, it sucks. It's like, you can either be a handmaid and live a horrible, boring, crushing existence. You can live as a wife and constantly be petty and jealous because you have no other option. Women in this society, it's basically impossible for them to have friendships. They're basically forced into hating each other.
Yeah, like, they kind of have these weird pseudo-friendships with the other wives, but you know that it's nothing but jealousy when one of them gets more status, and sounds pretty bad.
Yeah, and I mean, as from everything we've heard, the wives are miserable anyway, so...
Right, because they have no freedom.
Yeah.
They're not really any better off than the handmaids. A lot of them are probably not very... their husbands probably aren't very warm with them.
They can't have babies, which now is the entire point of society, so they're basically failures.
Yeah, and I gather that, at least in the case of of Fred's household, or I guess I should just say Fred's household, perhaps, there's not a lot of sex going on between husband and wife.
No, probably not any.
Probably most maybe of the commanders with handmaids, not so much.
Yeah.
If you had yourself a wife who could bear children, maybe some of those relationships are a little more normal, though the power's obviously way out of balance.
Yes. So, oh, and then some of the Marthas are kind of friends, but they have to be... the problem is you have to be friends with other women in secret, and you're constantly suspecting that they might be working for the government and rat you out, and so you can't really trust anyone, and therefore you can't be friends with anyone.
Right, I mean, you've stripped all the rights away from women, so if the three of them are together chatting and being all friendly, then you start to think there's a conspiracy.
Yeah, and then you can just pull them away in the black van and have them, what's the word?
Disappeared. What's the word they used, though?
Yeah, oh, crap.
I don't think I'm going to come up with it.
We wrote it down, salvaging. Salvage them.
Oh, that, yeah.
Yeah, hang them in front of everybody.
Yeah. and then go hang them on the wall.
Yep. Lovely.
Woo.
Do you want to go ahead and talk about some of the other characters?
Oh, a little bit, sure. We talked about Moira a bit. The commander.
Yeah, we talked about the household some more.
Yeah, the commander himself, good old Fred. Who, well, first he's faceless and, I mean, not quite nameless, but he only has a name because of Fred.
She always calls him the commander.
Right. And you don't really know anything about the man as a man. You just know that he's important enough to be referred to as a commander.
And he's neutral enough because he only sees of Fred when he's supposed to, and he only has sex with her, like, that one night, and it's totally a duty thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as gross and creepy as it is, you know that pretty much all guys are doing that, so he comes across as fairly innocuous.
Yeah, and then the relationship starts to change a little bit because he sneaks her into his study and play Scrabble with her.
I loved that scene so much.
Yeah, that was pretty good. And starts offering her some magazines she can read, and gets her some skin cream. And
he should some lotion.
He's like, it's kind of it's a really odd relationship. Like, you don't know, she doesn't know exactly what he wants, and I don't know exactly what he wants, but seems like he's enjoying watching her breaking the rules in front of him, and like maybe there's some fetish aspect to that, but he's not asking for sex.
No, and I mean, the first time they meet in secret, he goes, "I want you to play Scrabble with me." I was kind of like, that's a little bit adorable. This guy just wants someone to, you know, be mentally stimulated with, because he can't do that.
And I thought maybe he was trying to humanize this woman just a little bit that he had to have sex with once a month.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that would make it easier for him or something. And so I thought maybe his motives were goodish.
Yeah, he says some things that are kind of shitty, though.
Yeah, well, he starts to come a little more off the rails as it goes along, I think.
Yeah. I definitely went from not really caring about the commander to, oh, I kind of like him, you know? He's breaking up the monotony of her life and seems to actually be interested in her reading and learning things. And then, oh no, he's a giant creep.
Yeah, as it turns out, from a couple of different angles within the story, within the body of the story itself, he sneaks her out of, really, it sounded like to the outskirts of town or something, to a club hotel slash brothel called Jezebel's. And, well, now he is asking for sex.
Yes.
And that was definitely taking advantage of the power difference in the relationship.
And that's when they get to Jezebel's and he starts talking about it, you know, going, oh, isn't this better? The women get to, you know, dress up a little bit. But then he makes comments like how women used to trick men into wearing a different outfit each day so they appeared to be different women, so he didn't go chasing after others.
Yeah. So instead of that, you just come here, and there actually are different women. Instead of having sex with one woman, pretending to be a different woman every day with her new outfit, you can just
have sex with a bunch of different women.
Pick a new forced prostitute every week.
Yeah, it's so great. These women have to have sex with us. It's cool.
Yeah, Commander, that's real great.
Yeah, and then, oh, let's go up to a room together. She can't say no.
Yeah, he's not in any kind of position to say no.
And he doesn't seem bothered by that at all.
No, he doesn't care.
And the thing that Moya brings up when Fred is at Jezebel's is that, oh, he probably brought you here because some of the guys get off on bringing handmaids here and showing off to the other guys. And she's like, oh, crap.
Yeah, check out my handmaid.
Yeah, she's thinking, I had thought that he might have brought me here just to show me something new.
Yeah.
And no, it turns out he's probably just completely self-centered.
I drew a hot one. I'm going to go upstairs and have sex with her.
Yeah.
Without my wife.
And apparently he's a bad lay, according to Moira.
Well, on top of that, yeah. Moira would take the time to point that out.
I mean, he's an older guy, and honestly, if you are being forced to have sex with someone, then that's not going to be a good experience.
He seemed a little disappointed that Fred wasn't into it.
Yeah, she decided to try a little bit. Make a little bit of noise, move a little bit, but
yeah, but
That scene is super skeevy.
Yeah, it was not good.
Yeah. So the commander, douchebag, I think we'd safely say.
Yeah, especially when you get to the little historical note at the end of it. And we don't know exactly who he is because it's written in a very academic historian type of way. They have their theories on who it could be, and both of them are among the key architects of the society, so.
Yeah, we should mention, Ben's referencing is at the end of the book, there's a little section marked off as historical notes. And both of us thought, oh, this must be Margaret Atwood talking about her book, mentioning some of the historical things she took and put into the society. I was thinking, typically you see historical notes with books written, you know, a long time ago. Like when you read Hamlet, they might have historical notes on how Elizabethan England worked.
Or if someone writes a work of historical fiction.
Yeah. I was thinking, how does this book relate to historical notes? Oh, it turns out The historical notes are also written by Margaret Atwood, but in character still. You have this made-up professor talking sometime in the future, and he's a Gilead historian.
He's giving a lecture at some sort of Gilead conference.
Yeah.
And he's talking about this Handmaid's Tale, this diary that they found and have been analyzing. And that's where you learn some of this information. That's why I keep saying early and middle Gilead, because he kept using those terms.
It was pretty hilarious, because it sounded exactly like a historian talking about something they found written in ancient Rome, and this is why we think it's authentic, and here's some of the stuff in it that feels like it's maybe pointing to this. And that's the thing he says is, well, we know her name's Elfred, so we found two Fredericks who were involved in commander positions, and it turns out, yeah, both of them were horrible misogynists.
Yeah.
Like, I think one of them was quoted as saying, we never should have taught them how to read.
Yeah.
And the other one basically came up with the idea of salvaging and participation.
Yeah.
So.
Lovely gentlemen.
Yes. Anything we know about the commander in that little bit is, well, he's even more horrible.
Yeah. Good for him, right?
Hooray. Yeah, but this historical notes bit at the end, it's really interesting, because if you were just picking up this book and reading it, and you hit historical notes, if you're not like me and Ben, it's possible that you would just put the book down and go, oh, I don't need to read the historical notes. I got to the end of the book.
Yeah, okay, I don't need to know what societal artifact she's pointing at to show that this could actually happen.
It's part of the book.
It's part of the book. It was an interesting decision, I thought, to do it that way. Because the book easily could have ended without that section.
And still would have been good.
Wouldn't have been missed, necessarily. Wouldn't alter the story.
Too much.
Really. But it was kind of interesting that she chose to put it in that context. So here's this Gilead, and it rose, and presumably it fell, and now people have Gilead conferences because of such an interesting and quaint little historical development.
Yeah.
And so, it's like on one hand saying, look, the United States can turn into Gilead, and then on the other hand saying, but Gilead falls in a relatively short time because who the hell could sustain that?
Uh-huh. And it also points out some of the other things. One of the things I liked about the historical notes is he's saying, oh, you know, Gilead came into being right around the time the Caucasian birth rate was dropping so steadily. And then he's talking about how Gilead's a pretty racist place. So we can assume that everyone in of Fred's story is white. But then apparently other parts of the world without Caucasians, they're fine. Because he mentions that, you know, even the guys in Europe who don't end up becoming a theocracy who are Caucasian, their birth rate's lower too. But everyone else is cool.
Yeah, and I mean, there are some demographics that are probably, I don't know when they started coming in exactly, but there are a couple of nations in Europe where the birth rate is actually below replacement level.
Uh-huh.
And so, just a little thing that got woven in, and there's just a touch of eco-fiction in here, too, because the birth rate was affected, at least in the book, according to the book, by toxic materials and radioactive materials that have ended up strewn about the landscape. The causes of that are not listed in detail, but I kind of, oh, well, all you silly white people went ahead and wrecked your environment and then started having your population decline. And so you went to this insane repression of women's-based society that, come on, you've all really kind of wanted for a while anyway. And good luck with that.
Yeah, worked out real well for you.
Yeah. And now people who have very Native American sounding names are going to give speeches about the quaint little white people nation of Gilead.
Yeah, it's when they drop jokes about it and you have the parentheses laughter from the audience. Like, oh man, Gilead, you crazy people.
Those wacky Caucasians.
So that gives us even more context for the society, how it doesn't stick around, and how, yeah, most people view it as an interesting historical artifact. But we can guess that the professor who's talking about this has moved on from it. He never actually specifically said, yeah, we, you know, are better than them because our women are still going to college, but you can pretty much assume that there are women in that audience.
Yeah, well, the speaker who introduced him was a woman.
A professor who was
there,
a woman.
So there you go. So there are also lots of religious issues in here, in addition to feminism. We've referenced them a little bit already. But this is a theocracy. It is mentioned as a monotheocracy, and biblical verses are cited, so it's some form of Christianity, even.
Yes, the women are not allowed to read from the Bible, but before the ceremony, which is when the commander has sex with his handmaid, he reads out loud to everyone from the Bible. And I liked the fact that Fred pointed out that she knows some of those verses aren't quite right. They changed the wording somehow, but she's not allowed to read it, so...
Right.
She can't figure it out.
So they have themselves a version of the Bible. Maybe it's a new translation. Maybe it's one that's been altered to suit their needs a little bit.
It reminded me of medieval Catholic Church when people didn't know how to read. You know, the only people who were literate were church members.
Right.
And so you'd go to church and the priest would read to you from the Bible and then tell you, this is what's in the Bible and this is how to interpret it. And you'd be like, well, I can't check up on that. And one of Martin Luther, when he brought up around the Protestant Reformation, one of his big things was, you know, people need to be able to read the Bible and talk about it.
Yeah, maybe we should print it in the language that people know.
Yeah, which was, whoa!
Holy cow, what are you talking about? Crazy radical.
William Tyndale, the guy who published the Bible in England, got captured and executed for daring to do such a thing.
There you go. And so I would go as far as to say whatever group has taken control of the country here is some form of extreme Protestantism, just because that's what you think of in America when you think of these sorts of things.
It had the overtones. The thing that actually reminded me of Catholicism about it was the very beginning when it was talking about the handmaids being dressed in red, and I was thinking about cardinals being dressed in red, and so okay. I immediately went, oh, Catholic Church, even though women in the Catholic Church don't dress in red. My brain just went there. And then they were talking about persecuting Catholics, and I was like, okay, so they're not Catholic.
Right.
They persecute
Baptists.
So, okay, it's not the Baptists.
Jehovah's Witnesses,
Jewish people.
Quakers, not that Quakers would persecute anybody ever.
No. The Quakers are actually... As far as we know, the Quakers are the ones who help people who are trying to escape.
Because yeah, they're one of the groups.
Quakers are a nice people.
Traditionally, that's how Quakers have been.
Yeah, they're pretty inoffensive. Quakers would never take over a country and try to do that. So we know it's none of those. Like I was telling Ben before we started recording, it can't be the Episcopalians because they scarcely care enough to go to church. We can say that having grown up as Episcopalians.
Yeah.
Episcopalians are not radicals. Anglicans are far more radical than Episcopalians, and even they're not super radical most of the time.
Yeah, so maybe it's some evangelical branch that rises up out of some combination of something that exists, but it's never specifically mentioned which branch it is, probably because Margaret Atwood didn't want people burning crosses on her lawn.
That's what I was going to say. She's like, oh, no, it's definitely the Baptists. Then you'd have Baptists being like, excuse us. We don't do that.
Pardon me.
So it's probably better that she keeps it kind of vague.
Yeah, that's really okay with me. It seems literarily plausible. How about that?
Okay.
You can see enough elements in, especially the more extreme, again, usually the evangelical types of Christianity in the United States. You can see elements of the uneven power balance between men and women. The woman supposed to be submissive to the husband. The husband's in charge of the household. And, I mean, this is way more extreme than that.
Yeah, I think most evangelical sects would not say, don't let women read, for example.
Yeah.
They're not...
And then there's some pretty clear comparisons to some of the Islamic theocracies.
Yeah, they actually mention in the book that one of the reasons Gilead happens is they blame the attack that they construed on Islamic extremists.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
I did too.
I wanted to mention that later when we were talking about context and relevance.
When I was reading reviews of the book on Amazon, which I would not recommend because people are a little nuts, but a couple of the people's complaints on there were, this seems like it would way more plausibly happen in an Islamic nation because the women there are already oppressed to a degree.
You could kind of argue that they're kind of there already in some places, essentially.
And I think the point of the book is it's saying women got so close to being equal that it freaked them out, and they had an extreme reaction against this push and then pushed back.
Yeah, and I think that Americans specifically do tend to look at some of those Islamic theocracies and think that we're so much better than that. And that we, yeah, at least, you know, our women here at least are completely equal and have no problems whatsoever anymore. Right, guys? Elbowing the guy, the man standing next to him in the room.
The white man standing next to him in the room.
Exactly.
Women are equal.
Everyone's equal. We fixed it. We're perfect now. And there's definitely some commentary here saying, we're not quite there yet, guys.
We have a ways to go.
Historically, I think it would probably take more than a year or two to transition from our current society to the society of the Handmaid's Tale.
I definitely agree. And there is the element in there of a lot of women who wanted to resist didn't because they were trying to protect their families or realized they were just going to get mowed down. And there is definitely that group mentality in there of, you know, why didn't more Germans fight back against the Nazis? Oh, well, when you're in a huge group like that, it actually gets more difficult to stand up and fight against them. And there was some of that going on, of most of the women were just trying to keep their heads down instead of trying to change things. Whereas if 90% of the population rose up and said this is wrong instead of just 10%, you could never get away with doing that shit.
Yeah, I mean, Fred was definitely terrified for her daughter, more so than her husband, who she was becoming slightly resentful of by that point.
Understandably,
yeah. I just thought of a name for her.
Oh.
Yeah, she'd be like the Wotagonist. Because she's the woman protagonist.
And plus her life sucks, so whoa works there.
Yeah, whoa.
Whoa.
Wotagonist. All right, so let's hit a couple more of these events along the way, shall we?
Yeah, so one of the things with the book is we can't really go through plot points because there's not really a plot.
Yeah, I mean, there are events, and a couple of them are good-sized events. The book's kind of organized into these events, actually. Like, here's the shopping, here's the ceremony, here's the night out. But it's not one. It's not a narrative type of plot where event A leads to event B leads to event C. It's here are a bunch of events that happen, and then here's the end, and you see her.
Yeah. This is more an exploration of society and one woman's views of what's going on around her, as opposed to her going through an overarching storyline.
Yeah. And so most of these events, a couple of them are a little more personal. We've touched on, like, the shopping trip. Or the trip to the nightclub. We haven't really talked about her affair with Nick yet. But that, I guess it's not a single event quite as much, so.
Yeah, it's more at the end when she finally becomes less sexually oppressed and is able to have sex with Nick, I guess not every night, but pretty often. And he always lets her in, and they go about their business.
Yeah.
But it's kind of giving her this new sense of comfort in this world. You know, okay, things aren't as bad now that I kind of got some of my sexual expression back.
Right, and there's at least one person that, whether she can trust him or not, she has certainly put herself in a position of trust.
I mean, I would have liked more from Nick. He is not really a character.
He's like, kind of flirty and seems like he might become a character early on, and then he becomes the means of exchanging signals for her to know which knights to sneak into the commander's mm-hmm. study and play Scrabble. And then it's arranged through the wife to, oh, well, maybe the commander can't impregnate you after all. Go have sex with his driver.
And maybe, yeah, the younger guy.
Yeah, maybe he can do it. And then from there, she decides she's going to do it again.
And I mean, I can't blame her. I would totally want, if I was having sex once a month against my will in an entirely uncomfortable position, and all of a sudden here's this kind of attractive guy, here's at least some little scrap of emotion that I can cling to. She doesn't really get anything back from Nick, but she can at least believe that she has an attachment to him, so she has something.
Yeah, and through the book, there's been kind of a weird under-the-table connection between them anyway, though don't really fully understand it. Actually, early on, I was wondering if he was going to be a rapist or something.
Oh.
He made me a little uncomfortable early really? On, honestly, yeah. Like, when he was at the ceremony, when he was pressing his foot against hers, and she moved it out of the way, and he moved it back, and yeah. I was like, I don't know, I'm starting to sour on Nick a little bit.
It was a little uncomfortable. But as far as we know, he does try to save her at the end.
Yeah, he seems to be one of the good guys. From context, it seems likely that he is part of the resistance working with the Eyes, the uh-huh. spy organization. But we don't really know much about him as a person.
No. I mean, the most we get out of him is at the end when he's like, go with them, it's May Day.
Yeah.
Go off. And I was like, oh, yeah, we finally get something from Nick.
Look at that.
Oh, now the book's over, 2 pages later. Thanks.
And then, so there are these personal events, and then there are also these more, some of them are kind of more personal, like the ceremony is a small group of people, and then it's her being penetrated by this dude. But kind of like the more creepy societal events.
Such as the Prevaganza.
Prevaganza. Ridiculous name, by
that
the way.
That is hilarious. I think I laughed out loud when I heard Prevaganza.
Oh, jeez.
Which is a public... Well, they have women's and men's Prevaganzas. We should mention everything is split up into sex.
Well,
here.
Of course, you wouldn't want all those men being in the same place with all those women.
I'm actually also going to go so far as to say they're split up by gender, because in this society, if you're... For example, if you have man parts but you identify more as a woman, then you're a gender traitor and they kill you.
Yeah.
So sorry, gays, lesbians, and transgender people. Yeah, you just, you don't fit in. Jerks.
Yeah, well, it kind of goes hand in hand with the ultra extreme evangelicalism, right?
And if you're a woman and your purpose is to have a baby but you're only sleeping with other women, then...
Gender traitor.
Right.
Yeah, what good are you? You're not going to have babies.
Or if you're a woman and you don't have a vagina, then screw you.
Yeah. Could be in
there. Get out of here.
Hang you on the wall. Or make you an unwoman.
Yeah. Lovely. But the Prevaganza, so the women's Prevaganza, is, I guess, where they pray a lot.
Yeah.
And then the daughters get married off.
Yeah, the daughters are presented to angels returned from the front. So, in other words, veterans.
Mm-hmm. Men who have proved themselves in battle, who have now earned a woman. That's the way they put it.
Yes.
The younger guys have not yet earned women, so they can't hang out with them.
You can't have stuff that's as nice as those older guys. You need to go shoot a few infidels first, I guess.
Win your prize. Because everyone knows if you succeed in life in a business sense, you deserve to have a woman. Someone should just give you one.
Well, yeah. Just go to the store. So. Just go to the store and buy one. I go to Woman Mart.
Oh, God.
I can't afford their prices.
So horrible. I'm just, like, vomiting in my mouth. So bad.
And the Prevaganza, the daughters that are presented are pretty much from 14 and up.
Yes. And they've never met these guys.
Yeah. So, again, kind of the arranged marriage thing going on. Another element, common element of religions. I should really stop saying evangelical Christians, because even though they are noisy in this country, and you tend to associate some of these things with them to a lesser degree than it happens in the book. But really, in religion in general, this tends to crop up in young girls being married off to much older men.
Well, that's a historical thing, too.
Right, and it doesn't necessarily come out of the church, but you think of Mormon multiple marriage things that pop up in the news every couple of years. And
I know in ancient Rome, basically the second you had your period, you got married off. And if you were lucky, it was like a teenage boy, 17, 18, looking to get married. And if you were unlucky, it was, you know, a 40-year-old dude who had just lost his wife.
If you're really unlucky, it was Walder Frey.
Lol, Game of Thrones.
Lol, Game of Thrones.
But also, you know, in the medieval and Middle Ages, it was definitely all arranged marriages. And someone makes the point of, well, marriages for love aren't really more successful than arranged marriages. Mm-hmm. I guess in a bad marriage that starts out being for love, and a bad arranged marriage, you're both miserable, just in different ways.
Yeah. I mean, it depends what you're judging, what your criteria for judging are, too, because a lot of times works better equals fewer divorces.
Uh-huh.
In an arranged marriage situation, women certainly aren't asking for divorces.
No.
In those societies.
And in a lot of arranged marriages in the past, men cheated on their wives constantly.
Right, but that was what you did.
Yeah. Well, you don't marry for love, so you gotta go have sex with someone you actually like.
You have a mistress that you like, yeah.
And if you were super lucky, you happened to get married off to someone who you actually liked.
Right.
George III, who's the king who got his ass handed to him by America.
Depending on how you want to interpret that history.
He and his wife, who's a German princess, were madly in love with each other and had, like, 15 kids together.
Weirdos.
And he never had a mistress, and people thought that was so weird.
Right.
Like, because he had mental illness problems later on in
life.
And one of his doctors actually said, well, maybe the fact that you never had a mistress is the reason you're having mental illness now. And his wife was like, felt really bad about it. And he was like, no, that's not happening.
He was like, I'm crazy. Crazy for you.
So, I'd just like to point out...
Who's the king, baby?
Shut up. You're disgusting.
I'm terrible.
Talking about this book should have just been me talking to another woman. Stupid men.
I should not have been included this week.
No, I actually don't believe that. I think feminism includes men and women.
That's good, because I think I'm a feminist.
I would agree, even when you make stupid comments.
That one wasn't that bad.
So yes, arranged marriages... Probably not going to end up very well for these daughters.
Well, certainly they have no... Once again, they're women within a position of no power whatsoever.
Exactly. They at least get to knit during the day.
Yeah, right. And then the salvaging.
Which is kind of one of the more disturbing scenes.
Yeah. here are some people who have done things they're not supposed to do.
So we're going to kill them in front of everybody.
Right in front of you. And everybody has to touch the rope.
Yes, you have to touch the rope and pray, and basically everyone's giving their consent that these people will be murdered.
Yeah.
Like, we all agree.
And here's a rapist, ladies. Tear him apart with your bare hands.
Yep.
Participation.
Participation.
A combination of participation and execution.
And as far as we know, this guy who gets put up on the chopping block for these women to tear apart did not actually do anything wrong. According to Uv Glenn, who's part of the resistance movement, he was on their side and got caught, and so they...
Yeah, so she makes a point of getting ahead of the crowd and kicking him to unconsciousness before he gets literally ripped limb from limb.
Yes.
Because he suffers the least that way.
That would suck pretty hard. And the professor at the end, in the historical notes, mentions about participations that... They actually started getting scheduled on a regular basis in Middle Gilead to give the handmaids a chance to get out some of their emotions.
Right, some of their anger and rage at being kept in the horrible room of boredom all day.
Uh-huh.
Every day. Ugh. I guess we talked about the historical notes.
Yeah, we sure did.
That was our point of interest. We talked about it for a long time, so I guess that's not surprising. I also thought it was interesting that she went ahead and described the genesis of this dystopia via flashback. Mentioned that that happened, but in previous podcasts we have brought up that, hey, where do these societies come from? We never get to find out, actually, I think is what I said, and here's one where we get to find out.
Yep. The president and all the congressmen are, well, congressmen and women,
yes,
are shot to death, and then this new brand takes over.
We blame it on the Muslims that gives the presumably militaristic, if not military, junta in charge to declare martial law, lock things down, start passing crazy legislation, and by the time they get real crazy and do things like making it illegal for women to have jobs and money, no one can really resist them anymore.
Or they'll just gun you down.
So, talk a little bit about the writing itself.
Yeah, so one of the things I was thinking while I was reading it, at first it does take you a little bit to get into it. This is definitely not a casual contemporary writing style. Margaret Atwood definitely wrote specifically to be literary. All her word choice and sentence construction is very, very careful. So you never, you can read it and get lost in it, but it's never when you're reading a good adventure story. You don't get swept up in it that way.
Yeah, it's less what's going to happen next and more like, I want to know more.
Uh-huh. And after I got used to it, I really liked her writing style. I think you can tell that she carefully crafted everything and then she's good at it.
I got into it very quickly. It felt almost a little bit Hemingway to me, in that the sentences are frequently short. There's a lot of emotional content. Obviously, she has a higher opinion of women than Hemingway does. And then some of the jargon language, maybe my reading science fiction has helped with having a little bit of different sentence structure, because some authors have played with that. Most notably, Robert Heinlein, Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
You were obsessed.
A lot of people have trouble getting into that book, actually. More on that later.
The other thing about the book that's nice is, because it's not set up into, you know, here's how we got into this position and now I'm in this position, when you just get little bits of flashbacks going throughout, she's always giving you a like perfect amount of information and a flashback to make you go, oh crap, okay, what else? And you have to read more, and then you get a little bit more. And I thought where she chose you to give the information when she chose to give it was pretty much perfect.
Yeah, we agreed that the use of flashbacks was really effective in this book, and that her craftsmanship and technique of doing so was really good. This is clearly a writer who is very thoughtful and who knows what she's doing and is able to execute it.
I would say if you only like reading books for plot and entertainment, then you might not appreciate the writing style as much, just because it's not written for that purpose.
Yeah, and honestly, if you're into plot and entertainment, or for that matter, laughing and having excitement going on, I'm a little surprised you made it to this point in this episode.
This book is really depressing.
Because this podcast has largely matched the tone of the book.
You even laughed a lot.
I know.
Bummer.
A little bit.
Yeah, so anyone, that's the other thing about Amazon.com reviews, is there are people complaining about how she doesn't know how to write. Ignore those people. She does know how to write. Just she doesn't write in a way that's accessible to someone who's looking to read a Da Vinci Code, for example.
Correct. So we touched a little bit on the context relevance thing earlier. Didn't get all the way in. We mentioned how there are religious groups around the world, really, where this, you can see the relationship. And to make it a little more specific, to 21st century America, the war on women, you know, whether you believe it's a thing or not, there is something going on.
And I know, I feel like we've brought up the birth control issue in the past multiple podcasts, but honestly, that is really relevant to this book. Because one of the things that goes on here is they're saying women being on birth control is a huge reason for this mess starting in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, the book is really illuminating the point of, we're still arguing over what women's role in society really is, which is what the war on women is when you boil it down. It's, you know, what of this is a woman's absolute right, and what of this is something that the rest of society, aka the men running it, gets to decide. Yeah.
Do men get to decide whether or not you should have babies? And according to some people, yes, they do get to decide that.
Yeah, so they'll have handmaids someday, I guess. Unless you kill them all first.
I mean, maybe the abstinence-only people are onto something, because if you took away birth control, I would be totally abstinent. I'd be like, not risking it. Not having one of those things. I'm offending all the mothers. I'm sorry, but I'm not having a baby, so just putting that out there.
Not to offend any of you, but your babies are boring. They suck up all your time and money.
I made a huge mistake of talking to our mother about giving birth, and it was the most horrifying thing I've ever heard in my life.
Because she told it like it is, I have no doubt. She
put me off of giving birth forever. I'm just going to say that. I don't hate your baby. I just am afraid of everything.
I hate your baby.
Oh, shut up. You're an idiot. All right. So, wrapping up.
All right.
Questions for the book.
Well, you go first. You were angrier about this than I was.
Yeah. What is her name? I don't want to call her Of Fred.
Come on, Wotagonist.
I was so convinced she was going to give her name, and I was really disappointed. I understand why, because in the historical notes, the professor is saying, you know, she didn't actually give real names because she's still in danger potentially of getting kidnapped and shipped off and tortured, but still, I would have liked to know that.
It would have been nice to give a real name to this woman who feels certainly very real by the end of it. And also, did she escape all the way? Did she live a long, happy life somewhere outside of Gilead after she was taken away, presumably by the Resistance?
Or did they catch her and kill her?
She lived long enough to dictate her diary onto cassette tapes.
I like to think that she did, just because the alternative is too depressing for me.
It's depressing even if she does escape, so might as well let her have a glimmer of light there. So, your verdict.
I thought it was good.
It was very interesting.
Yeah, it's, like I said, it's definitely not a page-turning adventure story, but getting through all the aspects of society, the flashbacks and everything is very interesting.
It did read fast, actually, for me.
I think I read about two chunks.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it was thought-provoking, kind of in the way that made you mad and sad at the same time.
A little rage-inducing.
A little bit. It was kind of depressing. But, I mean, to be good, a book doesn't have to make you just feel
happy
or dumb and entertained.
It's true. It's a little heavy. And that would be the only warning I would give. If you like to read, read the book. But if you're one of those people who only picks up, you know, more thrilling type novels, it might not be the book for you.
Yeah,
I would recommend it.
The last three things you read were Men's Fitness, The Da Vinci Code, and TV Guide. This might not be your cup of tea.
Agree with that. So yeah, those are our thoughts about The Handmaid's Tale.
All right, let's get out of here.
Yeah. Get the hell out.
So, let's see. I am still slogging my way through. I shouldn't say slogging because I've read 6 books in like 10 days. But, well, okay, maybe 2.5 weeks. The Codex Alera. I haven't quite finished off the last book, which is called First Lord's Fury, for reference.
Go ahead and give the author again.
Jim Butcher, who is a bestseller. You want to read books that'll entertain you. These books will entertain you. And also known fairly, actually, maybe even better known for The Dresden Files, which is another series he has that I haven't read any of yet, but probably will now. And how about you?
I'm reading a book called The Truth About Forever by Sarah Dessen. The title makes it sound a little cheesy, but it's not cheesy. It's pretty interesting. It's kind of in the genre of teenager discovering who they really are through the shitstorm that's going on in their life, essentially.
Right.
So there's that little element of the hot dude that she's into, but it's definitely not a book about being into a hot dude.
Right.
It's definitely more about self-discovery. So, and it's definitely a lighter read. So if you're in for some light reading, then check that out.
There you go. After you read The Handmaid's Tale. So if you have any thoughts you want to share with us about anything we've said, or, you know, website maintenance, because we need to hear that stuff too, you can get us on our website, www.novelideaspodcast.com.
Or if you would like to contact us through email, if you don't want to get involved in a discussion in the comments thread, you can email us at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can get us on Twitter at novelideaspod. No cast. No room for the cast.
Just the pod. And if you listen to us on iTunes, we're going to go ahead and request that someone other than Caitlin please leave a review for us, so we can at least have an average rating, be slightly less pathetic. One day, maybe our iTunes will not look like horrible crap.
No promises. Maybe they'll help us fix it if we can get more than three listeners. All right, well, that is all for this week, and we'll see you next time.
No.
Uh-oh.
Next week.
I'm going to edit that out.
Okay. I'm going to give a little sense. So that's all for this week, and next week we will be reading Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke.
A classic science fiction novel that is actually not very light, so we're not going to be taking much of a break, but you can probably read it in one sitting, if that helps.
Which, you know, if you're reading along, we recommend it.
That's right. So that is all.
Yes.
For this week.
Yes.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.